Heads up, this episode contains spoilers, but honestly, from a movie you probably should have seen by now, people. Picture a little bushy-haired third grader, big thick plastic glasses, wearing a baseball shirt. He's cowering in a movie theater seat, eyes glued to the screen, mouth half open. That's me, at a matinee screening, July 1977, getting my mind blown. A few months before, I'd seen this new movie called Star Wars, and it made me and a few million other kids space movie obsessed. So now, July 77, the folks at MGM Studios are wisely capitalizing on this new audience by re-releasing another space movie, the one that's scrambling my young brains, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey. Honestly, I came in not expecting much. The film's old and rated G. I figured it would be like Star Wars with worse special effects and no shootouts. Instead, the first quarter hour doesn't even happen in space. It's about creepy, primitive ape men scrounging for food, howling at each other, being attacked by wildcats, huddling at night in fear in a cave. And then one morning, out of nowhere, appears the monolith. A tall, slim rectangle, impossibly deep black. The ape men swarm around it, their freaked out cries slowly drowned out by a choir of moaning, almost satanic voices, getting louder and louder. And I'm thinking, my God, how much louder is this going to get? And how much more can I take? It's an emotional reaction, like the dread you feel from the hum of buzzing bees. Now the ape men are touching the monolith in awe. Can they hear these voices? Are they becoming possessed? I've never seen a horror movie before. I figure this is what one must feel like. No words, no explanation. Just these intense visuals and that overwhelming music. This, I realize, is not Star Wars. 2001 A Space Odyssey is around 2.5 hours long with just 40 minutes of dialogue. In between, long stretches like these, some harrowing, some hypnotic, of just otherworldly images, atmospheric sound, and lots of classical music. That buzzing choral piece called Requiem by Georgi Ligeti, a 19th century waltz, a Soviet adagio. And when the film came out in 1968, the whole world was a lot like me in 77. A kid pinned to a seat, not quite sure what the hell was going on, but sensing everything he thought he knew about movies and movie music was wrong. I'm Rico Galliano, and welcome back to the Movie Podcast. Movie's the streaming service that elevates great cinema. On this show, we tell you the stories behind great cinema. Today, we launch Season 3. We're calling it Needle on the Record because we're diving into some of movie history's most iconic needle drops, those moments when filmmakers take pre-existing tunes, drop them in their films, and end up with something legendary. And you can't get more legendary than the soundtrack to 2001. Today, 55 years since it came out, it's still the ultimate classical music mixtape. The pieces Kubrick picked for it are still synonymous with space travel, but back then, even the concept seemed insane.
Some people thought that the waltz is not space music. It's totally ridiculous. How can you make such a technical movie with this high-tech and futuristic stuff and use a Viennese waltz? I mean, give me a break.
That is Kubrick's longtime executive producer, Jan Harlan, and he's one of many folks who told me how Kubrick came to pair waltzes with spaceships, about the musicians he pissed off along the way.
Ligeti went to see it and was furious about it. And in fact, he initially called the film a piece of Hollywood shit.
And about at least one musician who suffered for this film physically.
He was taken to the recording on a stretcher in an ambulance.
It's an epic tale about epic music So turn up the volume as we drop the needle on 2001, A Space Odyssey. To understand just how radical this movie's music was for the time, let's start by meeting a composer whose work did not end up in 2001, though he tried valiantly to get it in there. His name was Alex North.
He was a very gentle man. He was totally in love with his music and committed to music.
That's Stephen North, the late Alex's son. He's also a movie and TV producer.
His friends were musicians. Very often, I remember trying to sleep, and he would be doing four hands with Andre Previn and John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith on the two grand pianos.
How'd Alex end up jamming on his living room pianos with the greatest movie composers alive? Because he was one, too. Ever since 1950, when?
He was brought to Los Angeles by Ilya Kazan to score A Streetcar Named Desire. Which was the first film to use jazz as part of the core of the score, as opposed to just as incidental music. He then did the cinema version of Death of a Salesman. He did Viva Zapata, which was Kazan's picture as well. That was his introduction to Hollywood.
Pretty good introduction. All three of those scores got Oscar nominations. Then he got another for The Rose Tattoo in 1955, a year he was also nominated for Best Original Song, with a melody he wrote for a prison flick called Unchained.
Oh, my love, my darling, I've hungered for your touch.
Perhaps you've heard it.
A long, lonely time.
North, in other words, was on a roll, and he ended the 1950s with one of his greatest and definitely most fateful gigs, writing the score for the Gladiator movie classic Spartacus, his first time working with a then 30-year-old director named Stanley Kubrick, a guy whose four previous films had already shown he had a meticulous eye and a wide-ranging ear.
Kubrick was very familiar with classical music, and Kubrick played jazz drums. He played drums in high school.
That's Michael Benson. He wrote Space Odyssey, the making of 2001. For it, he interviewed basically everyone Kubrick ever met, including the director's wife, Christiane.
Christiane told me that he had a drum set up in their home, a jazz drum set up in one of the rooms, and he would blow off steam playing drums. So I've even compared Kubrick to a kind of jazz band leader in the sense that he was definitely in control. He was the director. He had iron control of his project, but he knew how to let his players solo.
Players like Alex North, who hit it off with his new director.
Well, during the making of Spartacus, they got on very well. Alex was privy to most of the cuts of the film and was brought in constantly to discuss concept with Kubrick, because Kubrick was very, very concerned about music and how it was used. So Alex had a very close relationship with him during the making and during the filming.
The movie was a huge hit, winning four Oscars.
The winner is Spartacus. Peter Ustinov and Spartacus.
And netting North yet another nomination. It was the biggest, most expensive flick he or Kubrick had ever undertaken, and they'd nailed it. It might have even been the beginning of a beautiful creative partnership.
But after the film was cut, Kubrick was no longer to be found.
Yeah, Stephen says he just winked out of Alex's life, incommunicado, which he says was not uncommon.
Kubrick is a strange bird. He apparently was best friends with Malcolm McDowell on Clockwork Orange, and they worked very, very closely together and spent a lot of private time together. But when the film ended, Kubrick never spoke to McDowell again.
Which made this next part extra surprising. Cut to Alex North 7 years later, December 1967.
He was called out of the blue. Alex was staying at the Chelsea Hotel in New York. Kubrick called him and said, would he be available to come to England that day or the next day to spot 2001?
What does that mean, to spot?
Spot is when you sit with the director and you pick the moments that the director wants music on the screen. I think that there was the first half, 70 minutes of film was done at that time.
And Michael Benson says after North saw that footage, Kubrick's long silence was quickly forgiven. Not just because the film was spectacular, but because there was so much room for music.
He was delighted at first when he heard about how little dialogue there was in 2001, and he naively thought that he would have that would give him more freedom and so on.
But actually for North, this was not going to be some carefree gig. In fact, he'd be just the latest player in a drama over the movie's music that had been unfolding for years. Flashback to the beginning of that saga, Sri Lanka, 1964. That's where the late great sci-fi author Arthur C. Clarke lived. And that spring, he got a letter from Kubrick, who introduced himself and asked if maybe they could collaborate on the story for a new kind of sci-fi flick.
He wanted to make the proverbial good science fiction movie, implying that there hadn't been any good ones before then.
That's Clarke, interviewed in Paul Joyce's documentary 2001, The Making of a Myth.
I didn't agree with him. There had been some good ones, Fantastic, Voyager's one. And I was rather fond of Things to Come, a version of H.G. Wells' book. And I got Stanley to see it, and he thought it was absolutely terrible. And of course, it was very naive.
Kubrick told Clarke he wanted to make a sci-fi that was intellectually deeper than those flicks, more inventive, with a vaster scope and a way bigger budget. And since he just scored a huge hit with the black comedy Dr. Strangelove, he could get whatever he wanted.
What Kubrick managed to do with all that credibility he had after doing Strangelove and with the full support of MGM was make an avant-garde experimental art movie on an epic, big-budget Hollywood pile of money.
And not just cash. MGM also granted Kubrick endless production time to innovate just about every aspect of the movie.
You know, 2001 was a research and development. It was a think tank from beginning to end. It invented dozens and dozens and dozens of new ways of producing film in visual effects, in makeup. The sound design was incredibly experimental as well.
There was just one thing the studio had expectations around, one thing they wanted that went without saying.
Oh, I mean, it was just assumed there would be a score, of course. You know, the film would have an original score. That was a requirement by MGM. It didn't even have to be stated. That was just the way things were. In big budget Hollywood productions, part of the whole PR strategy was to hire a big name composer and have an original score.
So after wrapping the live action photography for 2001, Kubrick dutifully hunted for someone to write a score as groundbreaking as the rest of his film. It turned out to be an odyssey unto itself.
It's really a very convoluted tale. I mean, first Kubrick approached Frank Cordell, who had done Khartoum, which was a United Artists Cinerama film. But Kubrick obviously didn't know what he wanted apart from having a fascination with Mahler's Third Symphony. And David DeWild, who's the first assistant film editor in 2001, told me that Cordell couldn't get a meeting with Kubrick and got increasingly tense and then finally had a nervous breakdown.
So one down. Next up, the great German classical composer Karl Orff,
who was then 71 and simply declined. I mean, he said, I'm too old to handle the pressures of such a major production. He might have also heard about Kubrick's reputation. So then Kubrick approached Bernard Herrmann, who did scores for Psycho and Vertigo and also Citizen Kane. And Herrmann detested Kubrick ever since Kubrick wanted him to do the score for Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, back then Kubrick bruised Herrmann's ego when he dared to tell him his score would be sharing the Strangelove soundtrack with a couple of lowly pop tunes.
And so Herman's response was, he said, well, I'm really busy, but I'll do 2001 for double my normal fee, which was a complete provocation, and he knew that Kubrick would never agree to that. Okay, so that's already three composers, one of whom actually tried to do something.
By now, it was 2 years into production. Some of 2001's long, wordless special effects sequences were starting to come together without any music. And right around then is when necessity led Kubrick to invention.
The MGM brass showed up to see a showreel in late January 1966. You know, so the initial impetus was, oh my God, the people funding this movie are showing up. We got to show them something. And we can't do it in silence. You know, he wanted to have some music to play. And, you know, he sent Tony Fruin, one of his assistants, off to buy something like $5,000 in today's dollars of records in a downtown record store in London called Discurio. And there were so many LPs in that car on the way back to the studio that Fruin was worried the police would pull him over because, you know, the car was sagging.
Fruin's haul included recordings of Mendelssohn, of course, Mahler, all the great composers. They picked the stuff they thought would work best for the MGM screening, and it went well. So well, the crew started spinning all that vinyl during their own screenings.
They had a hell of a lot of viewing of rushes in their screening rooms for 2.5 years of continuous production. And so it was far more interesting to watch that material with music playing.
Until one morning.
All of that resulted in a fortuitous moment when the space station footage, they had probably 10 shots of the camera moving towards this space station turning. And the Blue Danube Waltz happened to be queued up.
You know the shot. Everybody does. A space station, like two giant wheels connected with an axle, rotating above the Earth. As a sleek Pan Am space shuttle slowly moves towards it, also rotating as it lines up to dock. Two pieces of technology spinning together in circles. Like waltzing dancers.
Kubrick kind of, you know, lit up and said, would I be crazy or would I be a genius if I dared to use this piece?
Most of the crew thought he'd be crazy.
Nobody else liked it.
Jan Harlan executive produced Kubrick's last five films. But in 1966, he was a computer data processor who also happened to be Kubrick's brother-in-law.
I visited him on the set of 2001 quite often. And then one day he brought into the cutting room Johann Strauss, the Blue Danube Waltz. And again and again, and he heard it. And Ray Lovejoy told me the story. He was the editor. Ray Lovejoy became worried. What's this? The waltz is not space music. It's totally ridiculous. How can he make such a technical movie with this high-tech and futuristic stuff and use a Viennese waltz? I mean, give me a break.
Kubrick's response?
Anyway, let's try it. 2 weeks went by, and he edited this music to the film and was happy with it.
It seems like his first inkling that maybe he didn't need to find a composer to write him a perfect score. Maybe the most heavenly, groundbreaking music for his movie was already out there on vinyl. It was a suspicion that was confirmed almost immediately.
So, you know, essentially his inner circle was all instructed, please listen, keep your ears peeled or whatever, for works of music, you know, works of classical music that might work with some of these, you know, weightlessness scenes or the so-called Stargate sequence and so forth.
This is the BBC Thought Program.
And so one day in 67, Christiane Kubrick and the wife of one of the visual effects leads, Charlene Pedersen, were working together. They're listening to the BBC, and actually Christiane was not in the room because she was arranging for lunch to be delivered. And Ligeti's Requiem came on the radio. And Charlene immediately recognized it as a very powerful and unusual piece, and she ran to get Christiane, and they listened to it together.
And she heard Ligeti. She didn't know anything about him, but she heard this music, and she ran over to the cutting room and said, "Stanley, listen to the radio. I think this is what you want."
She was right, because what he wanted and what he'd been missing was something that conveyed exactly what I felt watching the movie, cowering in my theater seat in 1977.
This music that simultaneously conveyed horror and beauty and awe. I think that Ligeti's work changed the course of 2001 and Kubrick's thinking about the soundtrack. It just clicked into place such that Kubrick really couldn't justify using anything else, I think.
With Strauss's Blue Danube and Ligeti's Requiem both clicking, it was decided 2001 soundtrack would be nothing but classical needle drops. There's just one little problem.
When the MGM brass came to visit, that was always assumed to be so-called temp tracks. And then Kubrick tried to get MGM to agree to simply use the temp tracks. And they said, no, we're not going to, you know, you've got to have an original score. So then Kubrick was persuaded in November 67 to approach Alex North. And Alex North was the second composer to have a breakdown.
Yeah, remember Alex North? His crash and 2001's liftoff. Coming up in just a minute, stay with us. Mubi is a curated streaming service showing exceptional films from around the globe, all of them handpicked by real people who really know movies. So you can explore the best of cinema streaming anytime, anywhere. And if you love going deep into movies like we're doing here today, there is more where that came from, written by some of the world's best filmmakers, artists, and critics in Mubi's print-only magazine, Notebook. It is just a gorgeous thing to hold in your hands, and every copy comes with an exclusive surprise gift just for magazine subscribers. So do it. Subscribe now at mubi.com/magazine to reserve issues 3 and 4 delivered to you for free, no matter where you are. Finally, after you finish listening to me, you can stream some of the films we have featured on this very podcast. All you got to do is head to Mubi.com and look for the collection called Featured on the Mubi Podcast. Go figure. That's on the Now Showing page. As always, you'll find all the links you need in the show notes of this episode. Speaking of which, let's get back to it. All right, so it's December 1967. Alex North has just agreed to try his hand at scoring the first half of 2001. But according to Stephen North, it was clear from the start, this collaboration with Stanley Kubrick was going to be way different than the first.
He was given a year to do the scoring for Spartacus, and he was given literally 2 weeks to write the score for 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Why so quick? After more than 3 years of development and production, Kubrick had finally run out of time.
They had a release date already for the picture, and the film had been booked into theaters across America, and Kubrick wanted to hit the release date, and I think MGM was insisting he hit the release date.
In April, just over 3 months away. So that's a lot of pressure on North. But wait, there's more.
So from the very beginning of Kubrick's correspondence with North, North knew that Kubrick wanted to use classical and concert works.
That is Kate McQuiston. She is a professor of musicology at University of Hawaii at Manoa, specializing in film music, Kubrick's in particular. And from what she says, it sounds like Kubrick was still hoping to get his needle drops past the honchos at MGM.
But he would commission a score from Alex North that he would use in the event that he couldn't use the music that he really wanted to use.
So while North is writing the score, he knows Kubrick has his eye on using something else.
That's right. And I think he was hoping, as any composer in his shoes would have hoped, that he could come up with something good enough to replace these other pieces.
He just has to come up with something that beats Strauss.
It's a terrible assignment for a composer, to tell you the truth.
Now, accounts differ on the details here, but yeah, bottom line, North's job was to outshine some of the classical greats. And he tried really hard.
Kubrick rented an apartment for him and for his orchestrator, Henry Brandt. And they went to work with a recording date of January 1st.
Were you experiencing it? Were you with him, you know, in England at this time?
No, I was in England, but I wasn't with him. And I was precisely not with him because he said, Steve, I can't see you. I'm working 24/7. So we actually didn't see each other at all during the composing period. And as is famously known, he was taken to the recording in an ambulance.
Kubrick was astonished to see the composer arriving in a stretcher wheeled from the ambulance into the recording studio. So he was physically there, but he had a physical collapse.
Because the stress that he had been under writing this music completely put him out. And he had back spasms, which made it impossible for him to stand. And his orchestrator, Henry Brandt, conducted the score.
But Alex managed to get propped up in the control room, approving takes during the recording, while Kubrick, on the floor with the orchestra, looked on. And the good news?
Kubrick had been very complimentary, and not only complimentary, but had given very good suggestions about what Alex could do in the next recording session to improve on what they had done that day.
Except there never was another recording session. Steven says Alex got his full paycheck and figured Kubrick planned to use his work alongside the needle drops. But according to crew members Michael Benson talked to,
you know, he was far less diplomatic when he spoke to his inner circle. You know, he basically said, this is shit. Which was not fair, not at all fair to North, because he was just too in love with his temp tracks.
Now, I should say, some insist Kubrick actually gave North's score a fighting chance.
Once it grew on him, he edited even. He edited this scene of the Pan Am space model, you know, flying. He edited all, the whole thing, 2 weeks' work to Alex North's music. And he liked it, but he didn't love it. He had to love it. I can't stress it enough how important that is. And that's why it took him so long. Everything. He took a long time to finish a film. He had to be in love with it.
And at this point, yeah, even North's best work probably couldn't have made Stanley Kubrick fall out of love with his needle drops. Not just because he liked how they sounded, but also what they represented. Like, check out this North track. It's the one Kubrick dropped into the sequence Jan Harlan just mentioned, the Pan Am space shuttle docking with the space station. The scene Kubrick had originally paired with Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz. Kind of works, right? It feels like an elegant dance. Go on YouTube and you'll find fan edits of the scene swapping in this music for Strauss's, and it's pretty cool. But you can just tell, something doesn't quite fit the same way. And Kate McQuiston thinks, she knows what it is.
North's style is distinctively American. The voicings of the chords, the use of instruments, particularly the use of high woodwinds like piccolos and flutes in the high register, that was part of the American classical sound and as well the American film scoring traditions up to that time.
While on the other hand,
the Blue Danube waltzes were, in their time, a symbol of internationalism, a sort of international cosmopolitanism. And so I think Kubrick simply made the choices he made to try to achieve something that transcended, and transcended works in many ways here, transcended any particular national magnetism in the score for something more international.
Yeah, Kubrick's movie was about humanity trying to transcend borders, to break free of even the earth itself, and he'd pick music to match. Whereas North's work, as much as it danced, felt grounded to a specific place, on terra firma. That's one theory anyway, but whatever the problem was, now Kubrick knew he'd have to battle with MGM to go back to his so-called temp tracks. And it sounds like he wasn't sure it's a battle he'd win. In fact,
there's a little, very interesting little flash in the pan moment when Kubrick was exhausted and despondent about the fact that he didn't like what North had produced. At one point, Kubrick said, maybe I should contact the Beatles.
Hey, they just dropped Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, right? Which was pretty far out. But
finally, you know, conspiracy theorists might say, and I think North's wife did say, she thought Kubrick had this all in the plan anyway to delay and delay. And then finally, there was no choice but for MGM to agree to the temp tracks. But that story about the Beatles indicates to me that Kubrick really didn't know what to do and then finally had maneuvered himself into a position where the only thing to do was use these extraordinary pieces of music that we all associate with the film and are so perfect for the film that it's hard to imagine the film without them.
At first, though, things didn't seem quite so perfect. On April 4th, 1968, Stanley Kubrick attended the New York premiere of 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Christian Kubrick persuaded him to put on a tuxedo. It was one of the very rare sightings of the director in anything other than a rumpled blazer. And he spoke to the press.
Well, I became interested in the idea that the universe was full of intelligent civilizations, which is the current scientific belief.
And, you know, the screening was for predominantly older, entitled people who could get a ticket to the premiere screening of 2001. And it did not go well, to put it mildly.
What was the knock on it?
Oh, that it was incoherent, opaque. The leading film critics lined up to knock Kubrick down. In the Times, Renata Adler called it somewhere between hypnotic and immensely boring. In the Village Voice, Andrew Saris dubbed 2001 a thoroughly uninteresting failure and the most damning demonstration yet of Stanley Kubrick's inability to tell a story coherently and with a consistent point of view.
And Kubrick's choice of music wasn't spared either.
The critics didn't like it, generally, yeah, because Johann Strauss, I mean, goodness me, has old-fashioned music.
I remember Pauline Kael's response about the Blue Danube in this outer space context was that this was somehow a cynical commentary. She referred to Kubrick as having a sour heart.
The soundtrack even drew the ire of some of the musicians who were on it. Like, for instance, one Georges Ligeti, who went to see 2001 after someone told him his music was in it and was dumbfounded when he saw just how much.
The multiple tracks, multiple compositions of Ligeti's work that are in the film were licensed under this strange mechanical rights license, which allowed MGM to use those compositions as background music.
Except those tunes aren't background music. In some scenes, they're the only sound you hear for minutes at a time. Plus, one of them, called Aventures, had been electronically altered. Plus, apparently accidentally,
Aventures wasn't even in the credits. So he was very upset about that. And in fact, he initially called the film a piece of Hollywood shit.
And finally, there was Alex North. We saw 2001 and got the opposite sort of surprise.
He went to a screening in New York City, to an industry screening, and found out in that industry screening that not one note of his music had been used.
I mean, what was your dad's, opinion at that point? What was his feeling?
Well, he was devastated. He was shattered. And he was hurt even more by the fact that Kubrick never contacted him, never called him and said, Alex, I'm not using your score. But Alex never actually, till the end of his life, never heard from Kubrick again.
All in all, not an auspicious start to 2001's life. But while Steven says Kubrick never repaired his relationship with Alex North, he did make some repairs to his movie.
So the screenings for the press, the screenings for the first audience, were all a cut that had about 20 minutes more material than the film we know today. There were redundant scenes. And so there was an all-night session in the basement of the MGM headquarters in New York, and they cut about 19 minutes.
So they make these cuts, and then what happens?
Well, then a lot of critics either wrote about the film for the first time because they weren't in that New York circle, or some reevaluated and wrote second reviews. And meanwhile, the word of mouth was incredible. It was hard to get tickets, and they added additional screenings from the first weekend.
Despite the fact that the critics panned it.
Yes. And it was predominantly under 30s. Now, you probably remember that in the 60s, there was this line, never trust anybody over 30, which would have excluded Arthur Clarke and Kubrick. But the audience that got it most were under 30.
People who were like, I don't care what Andrew Saris says. I don't trust him to begin with.
Or they might even say, who is Andrew Saris? I don't know. And pass me that joint and let's go see that film.
Yeah, thanks to young moviegoers, some of them chemically altered, 2001 A Space Odyssey became the biggest box office hit of 1968. And the music hit a nerve too, especially the tone poem Kubrick had placed under the opening titles, composed by Richard Strauss.
I think also Sprach Zarathustra was probably not very widely known. Certain conductors liked Strauss's tone poems in concert for top flight ensembles, but also Sprach Zarathustra, probably less well known than the others.
After this movie, that changed.
A year later, the BBC played Zarathustra during TV coverage of actual Apollo space missions. In the early 70s, Elvis Presley's stage band played it as his intro music at concerts. Later, Deodato's disco jazz version hit number 2 on the Billboard charts. And you can probably name a couple dozen more examples.
20 years ago, for my film on Stanley Kubrick, I needed to have, obviously, the Richard Strauss. And I went to the publisher. I said, look, I make a documentary and I need to buy the rights from you. And he said, look, man, we are honored to give it to you for free. we made so much money because Stanley Kubrick used this. We sold it for commercials endless times, and we made a fortune with it. We are honored to give it to you for free.
I can tell you that all of those pieces became incredibly popular. The film was so popular. I mean, Kubrick had never had a highest grossing film of any year before or since. And people wanted that stuff so they could play it at home. And so, yeah, the soundtrack was very successful and has been re-released ever since.
And that's how the atonal, mind-piercing music that freaked me out in that theater in 1977 ended up on a certified gold record. All of which marked a turning point in the relationship between movies and classical music. Till then, there was the lofty classical world and there was Hollywood pop culture. And only rarely did they meet.
And we can even look at Alex North's own career as an example. He really wanted to be a composer of serious concert music. And he came to film scoring very reluctantly, as he tells it. So I do think for those who had classical aspirations, it took a very long time for working in film to cease to be a stigma.
2001 went a long way toward erasing that stigma for good. Meanwhile, for filmmakers, the movie opened up whole new ways of marrying music, especially classical music, to images.
And I think we still see plenty of evidence of Kubrick's influence. If we think of something like Paul Thomas Anderson's There Will Be Blood, it includes a Brahms violin concerto, and it has music by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt. Or there's Terrence Malick's Tree of Life.
Life, my life. I search for you.
Which, to my mind, is a very elaborate musical extravaganza.
My hope.
It's a visual accompaniment to music.
My child.
By composers including, gosh, so many, Mahler, Smetana, Respighi, Taverner, Holst, Goretzky, Berlioz. That's a film that couldn't exist without 2001.
Yeah, it's almost like he gave the idea that you can just have these bliss outs of music and image and it will result in something transcendent, maybe.
Yeah, I love the word bliss outs. And it does highlight the fact that Kubrick wanted people to hear this music. Kubrick was such a fan of classical music.
And though he could obviously be a difficult guy, classical musicians came to respect Kubrick too, including, by the way, Ligeti, despite his whole piece of Hollywood shit thing.
He gradually modified that opinion. And I think the reason he modified that opinion is, first of all, MGM made an appropriate payment, but I wouldn't be so crass as to say that Ligeti modified it because he was paid off. I think he realized, like a lot of people, he needed to reevaluate 2001 and see it a couple times before he recognized what was going on. And certainly it's undeniable that Ligeti's career catapulted from obscurity into this kind of front rank of avant-garde composers of the last quarter of the 20th century.
His work ended up in two more Kubrick films, The Shining and Eyes Wide Shut, fully credited and paid for, I should say. And as for Alex North, he actually came out of the 2001 Crucible okay, with his music in hand.
Kubrick was very generous in one way. When he didn't use Alex's score, he gave Alex back the rights to his score. And it turns out that one of his longer cues, he used in a picture that he scored for me, a Marcel Marceau picture called Shanks.
Oh, right. You produced Shanks.
And there's a whole cue in that picture. Maybe it's a 3.5 minute, 4 minute cue, which is directly out of 2001 A Space Odyssey.
And am I remembering correctly? Shanks is it's a horror movie, and like starring a mime.
Exactly. Exactly.
Not exactly anything like 2001, and yet the music was, you know, usable.
And not only usable, he was nominated for an Academy Award for it.
That, to me, is an artist's career, right? Sometimes full of horror and awe, like a wailing choir, and sometimes all of a sudden spinning elegantly, full circle, like a waltz. That's the Mubi Podcast for this week. Follow us to make sure you get a front row seat for more deep dives into music and movies. Next week, the story of a box office flop that rose from the ashes of 9/11 and sent an unlikely cover tune to the top of the pops.
It was so big. I mean, it's hard to fathom how big. I mean, people were calling in the radio saying, like, I heard it and I pulled over on the highway because I couldn't drive and listen to it at the same time.
Donnie Darko helps pull Tears for Fears into the 21st century. Follow us so you don't miss it. Meanwhile, this episode was hosted, written, and edited by me, Rico Galliano. Jackson Musker is our booking producer. Kira McKenniff is our producer. Stephen Colon mastered and engineered. Martin Ostwick composed our original music. Additional music by the most excellent band, People with Bodies. Thanks this week to Rebecca Wyman, David Harper, J.P. Davidson, and Mike Pacelli. The show is executive produced by me, along with John Baranichea, F.A. Checkerell, Daniel Kasman, and Michael Taka. If you love the show, tell the world, won't you, by leaving a 5-star review wherever you listen. It helps others find and love us, too. Also, if you've got questions, comments, or if you've got a fan edit of 2001 you want me to check out, email us at podcast@mubi.com. And of course, to stream the best in cinema, including some of the films we talk about on this very podcast, just head over to Mubi.com to start watching. Thanks for listening. Be safe. Now go watch some movies.